Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Okay, wow. Good evening, everyone. For those who don't know me, my name is Larry Kramer. I'm the President and Vice Chancellor here at LSE, and it's my privilege to welcome you all to tonight's very special event, a conversation with Nick Clegg on his new book, How to Save the Internet. I did know that. I didn't have to look at the page to know that. I'll say a bit more about Nick in a moment, but I want first to acknowledge our host for this evening, which is the LSE Program on Cohesive Capitalism. So Cohesive Capitalism is a major new initiative here at LSE, and it's aimed at shaping a new political economic paradigm to better serve the common good. So it brings leading thinkers from across the social sciences together to explore the values, institutions, and policies needed for a more democratic, inclusive, and cohesive society. So for anyone who knows anything about tonight's speaker, Nick, it's not surprising that he was in the sights of the initiative as someone we wanted to bring here. After a somewhat wayward youth at Cambridge, the University of Minnesota, working for Christopher Hitchens and Guy Speer, more study at the College of Europe, a stint as a reporter for the FT, and a variety of positions in the European Commission, Nick entered politics as a liberal democratic member of the European Parliament in 1999. What followed then was a meteoric rise into the House of Commons in 2005 and then leadership of the Liberal Democratic Party in 2007. As party leader, he moved the party into a position he described as radical centrist, supporting lower taxes, electoral reform, cuts in defense spending, and an increased focus on environmental issues. When the Conservative Party failed to achieve a majority in the 2010 election, it formed a coalition with the Liberal Democrats, which had won 57 seats, and Conservative leader David Cameron appointed Nick Deputy Prime Minister. Now, in that capacity, Nick made a controversial decision that affected everyone in this room, or pretty much everyone in this room, but also lost him his position. He abandoned his party's pledge to oppose increases in tuition fees, which had been a key issue when the party that had won the party support from students. Now, inasmuch as the government at that time was not prepared to continue covering costs and was rather looking at massive cuts in funding for instruction, that decision arguably saved universities at the time, which is why it affected all of us here. It nevertheless cost his party dearly in the 2015 election, leaving the Liberal Democrats with just 8 seats and resulting in Nick's resignation as party leader. In 2018, Nick relocated to the United States to become vice president of global affairs and communications at Facebook, which, as you know, was renamed Meta in 2021. He was promoted to president for global affairs in 2022, but stepped down from that role to return home to the UK in 2025. Since returning home, Nick has spent time raising his sons, helping his wife Miriam, a formidable lawyer and politician in her own right, launch a political party in Spain, and helping a clueless American friend he met while living in Silicon Valley find his footing in London as president and vice chancellor of LSE. And writing a book, which is, of course, the subject of tonight's discussion. So we'll begin by inviting Nick to take a few minutes to lay out the basic thesis and argument of the book, after which he and I will spend some time teasing out the ideas further in conversation. And then after that, we'll open things up to questions from the audience. After the event, Nick will be there'll be a book sale right outside. And then if you want, you can come in and Nick will be available to sign the book up here on the stage. And with that, let me turn the mic over to tonight's guest, Sir Nicholas Clegg.
Well, thank you, Larry. I didn't know you were going to give this sort of potted history of my triumphs and disasters in public life. It's giving me a sort of hint of PTSD just listening to it, but it's lovely. And in fact, there are some things I could quibble with as well about that potted history, but I will come back to that maybe on another occasion.
Well, you have to talk to Wikipedia.
Yeah, right. Firstly, it's lovely to be here. It's so nice to see so many of you. Thank you for giving up your time for this event. Why did I write the book, I think, is what you want me to just quickly dwell on. I'd sort of had this rather unusual, wholly accidental, not sort of deliberate, career of 20-odd years in public office and politics in Europe and Westminster, as Larry described, and then 7 years in a sort of senior capacity in one of these great big monster companies in Silicon Valley, and rather unusually I think I was probably the only sort of ex-politician in a sort of senior executive position, certainly one of the only ex-European politicians to be in that capacity. And lots and lots and lots of books are written about big tech, a good or bad. There isn't a week that goes by without a flurry of new books being written about this. And I didn't really want to... I enjoy writing books. I've written a few books, but I didn't really want to go through the whole palaver of writing a book just to go over a lot of that ground. So the thought sort of crept up on me that as I was doing the day job... there is the aforementioned Miriam, by the way, entering on Spanish time. only 5 minutes late. As I sort of... beetled around the world on behalf of Facebook, now Meta. It crept up on me that I was seeing a very powerful but somewhat under-analysed and under-commented on trend in all the interactions I was having with governments, with regulators, with lawmakers, with other tech companies, which is, as I describe in the book, this... constant incremental fragmentation of the online world and what's sometimes commonly called the move towards a sort of splinter net. And there are lots of reasons for that. There are some geopolitical reasons for that. There are regulatory reasons for that. There are cultural reasons for that. There are technical reasons for that. But the longer I worked for one of these big sort of global platforms, and interestingly, even though these US companies are extraordinarily American in outlook, in culture, perhaps even more so now in the way that they have sort of become almost joined at the hip with the Trump 2 administration, they are quintessentially global entities. I mean, I'd probably need to check the specific data, but I think well over 90% of the users of Meta's products, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, and so on, are outside the United States. But about 95% of all of the energy in terms of how the company is sort of governed and run is American. So you've got this great mismatch between the very sort of US-centric culture of Silicon Valley and the very global presence with which they are their products and apps and services are used across the world. And so it is my view, as I describe in the book, that unless there is an active political decision by the major techno-democracies in the world, and I count the US, India, and Europe probably in that descending order of importance, unless there is a deliberate act by those major techno-democracies to establish new guardrails, new swim lanes, new common approaches to the governance of the online world, particularly in an era of AI, it is my view that current trends will drive the internet as we know it from a relatively open experience, certainly outside China, where data flows seamlessly, where we can share content and data from jokes to satire, from misinformation to short-form videos, effortlessly across the globe in a way which doesn't recognize geography. I think we will find over the next decade that seamless open experience will instead become one which is more balkanized, more fragmented, where there is more friction in being able to communicate from one jurisdiction to the other. And I think all of those trends, like many trends, as I no doubt will discuss, are only going to be accelerated by AI and divergent responses to AI in society. And so it's like a sort of, it's like the sort of frog, the slow boiling frog problem. The fragmentation of the internet is something which happens slowly, and you only really notice it when it's too late to do anything about it. And that is basically why I thought I'd write this book, because I don't think enough attention has been devoted to this growing balkanization of the internet. And as I set out in the last third of my book, much as the internet, as we know it, really came about by accident. There was no blueprint, there was no common design, there was no top-down design said, this is how the internet shall be born. It was sort of incremental, almost organic process of innovation. A lot of it spun out from the kind of defense-funded research in Silicon Valley. It was then layer upon layer of innovations and different norms and standards. There was no overall kind of central design to the internet. So it's a magical thing, I think, that this thing, this extraordinary, all-encompassing phenomenon should have almost really come about through accident. But I think it can die through neglect. And so my view is that much though it has always flourished, in a sense, through benign neglect, the global governance of the internet in an age of AI, and particularly in an age of deglobalized political deglobalization, needs this deliberate act of political decision making amongst the major techno democracies. And the final sort of point I'd make is the backcloth to all of this, the book, are these two great big forces that are colliding with each other and will continue to shape our world. It's the globalization of technology. AI is the only the latest manifestation of technological innovation that doesn't recognize geography, doesn't recognize borders, and the rapid deglobalization of politics everywhere, whether it's Brexit, whether it's Modi, whether it's Trump, it doesn't matter, Erdogan. Politics everywhere is about retrenchment. Perhaps, thing to be debated in halls like this, perhaps the latter is a reaction to the former. But these two things are increasingly, I think, becoming uncomfortable bedfellows, the globalization of technology and the deglobalization of politics. And I think a lot of that is what is driving this fragmentation, which I believe needs, as I say, a deliberate act of political will to avert the worst in the years to come. So that's the book in, what, 4 or 5 minutes? I think I managed it. Just so you don't need to read it now, but please do.
But still buy it.
Yeah, buy it. You don't read it. I mean, just buy it. Yeah, exactly.
So in some sense, and I'm going to slightly oversimplify this, but the kind of core value that has always driven Facebook was this notion that connectivity is just an unqualified good.
Right.
And that anything that increases it is good, and that things that make it easier for more people to connect with more people is the driving idea, even when it conflicts with almost any other value. And then a lot of the controversies involving Facebook over the year were where it did conflict with other values. And, you know, there was this sort of acknowledgement of error, claim that we would fix it, and then a retreat back to that same value. And that's been the kind of pattern. And the reason I mention that is, as Nick knows, is the book has come in for some harsh criticism here, at least in the British media, basically for being just a defense of Meta. Mm-hmm. And so I assume I want to give you a chance to answer that, since that has been overriding.
Yeah, I mean,
why are they wrong?
Well, the British press, where do I start? I've never had the most fruitful relationship with large parts of it. To be very specific, the book is not actually about Meta. That's actually not what it's about. It's not about Facebook or Meta, but it certainly covers in the first third, because it'd be rather odd for me to spend so much time in Silicon Valley not to talk about it. But that's actually not the central thesis or argument of the book.
Right, although in some sense it's a defense of that approach,
well,
that value.
To that extent, yes, it is definitely a defense of openness and the value of connectivity. And I suppose I do, by temperament and by disposition and by outlook, generally think, maybe I sound like just the most woefully unfashionable globalist, but I do think that connecting people across jurisdictions and cultures and places is generally a good thing to do. I generally think history suggests that when we build barriers, reject each other, vilify each other, push away the other, it doesn't turn out very well. And I'm a child of globalization, and I unfashionably believe that there's a lot about the period of post-war globalization which has brought untold bounties for us. And I think the internet is very much part of that. So yes, I do start from an assertion that openness and the ability to communicate with others, but perhaps much more important than that, because it's the corollary of the openness, the ability, which is what social media has brought to billions of people around the world, to express themselves and to avail themselves of these tools for free, because it's paid for by advertising, I think is on balance and an unalloyed good. I think, in that sense, I am an apologetic sort of old-fashioned liberal who believes that if you empower people to express themselves without having to wait for the say-so or seek the permission of religious or political or ethnic or other leaders, it is a good thing. And I think social media has emancipated self-expression on a vast, vast scale. It doesn't mean it hasn't come up, hasn't allowed for a lot of bad people to say a lot of bad things as well, and we can no doubt come to that. But yes, I do start from the assertion that this technology, because of the way it's built, because of the way it's paid for, I think has had a very powerful democratizing impact on communication and self-expression around the world. And I think anything which inhibits that is generally a bad thing, particularly when the inhibition of it is invariably authoritarian or semi-authoritarian or self-interested political players trying to interfere with the way in which their citizens express themselves. And they might have very good reasons to do so, but at the end of the day, it is a conflict between the self-empowerment that I think these technologies can bring to people and various forms of political authority trying to control or limit what is said and what is done online, and I will generally always be in favour of the former and against the latter. So, sorry, what was that? Well, the Meta. You know, the book's not really about Meta. Look, I mean, don't read that. If you want a book which is a sort of kiss and tell book where I say I've seen the belly of the beast and they're all demons and they should all be locked up, don't read it. That's not what the book's about. It's not actually what I think, and I wouldn't even write it, I suspect, if I thought that. It'd be rather silly thing to go and work for this company for 7 years and then sort of trash them. In that case, I shouldn't have worked there in the first place. So I'm afraid I unfashionably don't subscribe to the well-articulated and rather sort of fashionable throwaway caricature of these companies and this technology. And so I challenge a lot of those assertions, some of which I think hold some water, some of which I think are manifestations of a moral panic about technology, which we always have as a society. I was had a drink last night with Ian Livingstone, a wonderful British legend of the games and gaming industry. He was recalling to me, and I remember as a kid, the moral panics around gaming and video games in the 1980s. You know, if you looked at a particular game for more than 10 minutes, you were in danger of becoming an axe murderer. I'm being facetious here, but I unpack a lot of this in the book. I try and unpack it not in my name, still less in Meta's name. What I try and do is say, here are the claims made, for instance, about the link between the use of social media and political polarization. Here is the counter evidence, and I try and marshal academic evidence. And sure, I hope the book is of some interest, because it's not just repeating what I think are a lot of well-worn, unempirical platitudes about technology and society. It challenges some of those things, and I guess, of course, some people don't like that, because it's much more comfortable to say it's all the fault of big tech. If only we could tweak, again, I'm being facetious here, if only we could tweak the algorithms, all would be well, the sun would shine, democracy would flourish, Brexit would not have happened, Trump would not have been elected, all this kind of stuff. I just think all of that's nonsense. I think it is reducing highly complex reasons to a sort of techno-determinism that somehow it's because what you know you see on your feed that makes us feel and think and say things that we otherwise wouldn't do. There's very little evidence for that. But you can judge for yourself. I try and lay it out as dispassionately as I can. But yeah, I suppose some people don't like it because it is highly fashionable and no doubt if you're trying to sell books, quite lucrative these days, to publish books or write articles saying that it's all the fault of technology and it's all the fault of these algorithmic systems. I think there's a lot that is wrong with them, and there's a lot of things that I spend a lot of time changing, and I like to think changing for the better. So I'm not naive about these things. I just don't believe there is any evidence, and I don't think there has been down history. I mean, if you look at the moral panics around, you know, when bicycles were invented, it was considered to be particularly subversive and dangerous for women because they'd be, you know, sitting astride this bicycle thing. The radio was considered to be, a favourite tool for fascists. Electricity was considered to be a deeply dangerous thing because it would light up your house and thieves would be able to see when you're at home. I mean, literally, this is well documented. And if you look at some of the adjectives and adverbs that are used every time you have these new technologies, it's unnerving how similar they are over history. And quite rightly, a lot of those fears are then particularly focused on the effect on the young. I think there are a lot of very legitimate concerns about the effect of social media and the use of social media on the young, none of which I duck in the book. In fact, I think personally governments could go a lot further than they currently have. But to give you a long-winded answer to your first question, I will be shorter going forward. I give a nuanced view. I try and marshal the evidence and the counter evidence. Decide when you read it. But yeah, to your question, I guess some people don't like that because nuance is irritating.
Okay, so let me, there was a lot in that answer. Yeah. I want to touch on, I think, three of the different points, right? That, again, come back to the core idea is still openness is better, right? Connectivity is what we're after. We should avoid things that limit that. So just to touch on three of the criticisms that are often made of it. So one, you touched on there at the end, which is the arguments about social media's impact on democracy and on young people. On their mental health. And okay, so the argument is that's overstated. It's based more on correlation than causation. And I actually think that the really strong social science critiques of the book are consistent with that in the sense of absolute causation shown. But that is when the argument is made sort of as if social media is the sole cause.
Right.
But I think more realistic and what's, I think you're agreeing is plausible, is social media is at the very least a major accelerant, an amplifier of it. So then, you know, don't we have to hold tech leaders accountable for how their algorithms are exacerbating the problems? And then we're into the area of regulation that seems to be counter to what you're trying to argue for.
Yes.
So how
so
do
I
you...
agree. No, I basically agree. I basically agree, firstly, with the assertion that, which, to be honest, is not often made. This is my point. My point absolutely not is that technology and all the time we spend on our phones and the apps that particularly kids use and the algorithmic recommendations that are you know fired at people. I'm absolutely not pretending that that is somehow a risk-free exercise or doesn't have a number of collateral effects which can be negative as well as positive. I strongly believe that it is there is an over-ascription. Do you say that? People are over-ascribing to those technological factors a whole bunch of wider forces that can drive, whether it's political behavior, whether it's the shifts in the patterns of adolescent mental health and so on. So it's not that I'm saying it has no role. Of course it must do. I think it is just sometimes described as the sole or the principal driver of behavior, and that in turn, I think, leads to something which worries me, because it leads decision makers and the population at large thinking there's a technological fix to these things, and there very rarely is. You can improve technology, you can put guardrails in, you can regulate, we'll come to that in a minute, you can do all of those things, but there, I worry that sometimes it is described in such breathless terms that, you know, if only these amoral people in Silicon Valley would do something different, then all would be well. And that is the sort of falsehood that I think has taken root in recent years, which I think is simplistic, is not backed up by any of the evidence, and will leave a lot of people very disappointed. On regulation, I mean, one of the first things I did when I arrived in Silicon Valley in late 2018 was to persuade Mark Zuckerberg that Silicon Valley needed to sort of stop this, what I felt at the time was sort of ludicrous assertion, which all the tech leaders were making at the time, against any kind of government intervention, any kind of regulation. And he then put his name to an op-ed, I think, in the spring of 2019 as the first Silicon Valley leader saying, of course there's a role for government, of course there's a role for parliaments and so on. I'm not against that at all. And in fact, when it comes to kids, I spent a lot of time trying and failing to persuade ministers in this country to go further than they have done in the legislation which recently has been put into the statute book in this country, the Online Harms Act, in terms of how you verify kids in order to make sure that teens, particularly between the ages of 13 and 16 or 16 and 18, consume age-appropriate experiences. And I think there's a whole much further they could go. What I am arguing, though, and I don't think this is inconsistent in the book, is if every country regulates in dramatically different ways for a technology which, for all the reasons we've discussed, doesn't know borders, then you'll get this patchwork of regulation which will lead to the sort of fragmentation that I don't think people want. So I'm all for sensible regulation. I just think it makes a lot more sense when that regulation is done in a more coherent and consistent way around the world.
Just say a few words about what then would count as sensible regulation. Take the two kids, youth, I think you hinted at that one, and the democracy problem.
Well, I think on the youth thing, look, at the end of the day, you have to decide as a society, and this is not something that should be left to tech bros, it shouldn't be left to the engineering companies or the Silicon Valley people. They're not, these are business people. They're not philosopher kings. We shouldn't be remitting our governance to them. We should decide as democracies, do we think, I don't know, that no one, kids shouldn't use social media from the age of 16 or 15? I noticed yesterday the Danish government have announced they're going to put a prohibition on using any social media under the 15 and below. I think Australia's passed legislation for 16 and below. You can pick your age. I mean, I personally think, saying as they are in Australia, that 15-year-olds can't look at Ronaldo and Messi scoring goals on YouTube anymore, I think it's not going to work. And I don't, but never mind. Let's say we have a societal consensus arrived at through democratic process that there should be no social. Let's call it 30, 40, something like that. Then you have a problem, and the problem is, how on earth do you police that? And how on earth do you police that at a time when young people in particular are extraordinarily versatile at using lots of different apps at the same time? I think the average American teen is now estimated to use more than 40 apps every single month. And as you will know, for those of you who either do that or have teens, you know, it's often you'll use one social media app for your public identity, another messaging app for your private messages, another one for your music, another one for your... People are using these apps in a very interchangeable way. So you have to come up with something that can then police that new age limit, let's call it 14, across all of these apps. And that's the thing that this government and other governments around are failing to do. Because if you ask the apps, which is now the law of this land, to basically come up with their own verification, age verification processes, you get the mess we now have, which is that it's different on TikTok, it's different on Instagram, it's different on Pinterest, it's different on Snap. Parents have no idea what's going on. They've got different flows trying to verify age on different apps. In my view, there is a technical way that you can force on the whole industry, on all the apps, a simple way of verifying age. You do it at the app store level. In other words, the two app stores, which are the two choke points of the internet, the iOS and Android app stores, and you work with them, you basically mandate them to ensure that at the point at which the app is downloaded, there is age verification, which then applies to all apps which are downloaded by that device using the app stores. That's just it's rather techie, but it's rather important, because I think what we're now doing is that the politicians say, job's done, the newspapers are full of, oh yeah, we're biffing Silicon Valley on the nose, and there's going to be this age verification. And meanwhile, families are left completely confused, particularly parents who don't use online stuff a lot because they're having to run through so many different hoops. So that's one example.
Do democracy and misinformation.
So I think that's way hard. I think some of it is easy. I think, for instance, how politicians and campaigns use the targeted tools that a lot of these platforms have to target messages or political ads. Again, you just need to make a choice. Maybe you don't want to have political ads at all. I mean, I tried and failed early on in my time in Facebook to persuade Mark Zuckerberg and the board to stop running political ads altogether, because I thought it was a total nightmare for the company. It just caused endless controversy, generated almost no revenue whatsoever. But for various American reasons that you'll be familiar with, Larry, there's weird jurisprudence that seems to think that paid political adverts are a form of self-expression somehow linked to the first. You can explain that. Somehow linked to the First Amendment. Never got that myself, but never mind. It didn't happen. But you know, again, that's just kind of just decide. You don't want political ads, or you don't want targeting. Just decide. Pass the law. Make sure you apply to everybody. I think misinformation is way, way, way hard. Because, unfortunately, it sounds terrible. We all in this room, no doubt, whoa, we don't like misinformation. Misinformation is something that's half true and half false. It's someone talking complete nonsense. It's gossip. It's malicious stuff that is deliberately kind of out there, but it's kind of, it's not illegal. Misinformation's not illegal. So this is all, when people complain about, oh, I don't like this online, that online, it's content that democratic governments and parliaments over generations have deemed to be perfectly legal. And here's the great problem with misinformation. It's one of the basic tenets of a free society is to talk rubbish, to talk crap, to talk nonsense. How on earth do you police that? How on earth do you police that in a society where there is absolutely no consensus about where the line would be drawn? I guarantee you, you guys in this hallowed hall in the LSE might be able to come up with a understanding you all share about misinformation. But you try and get Nigel Farage to agree to that, and the millions of people who support him, you will fail. because one person's hate speech is another person's right to free expression. Again, all about content that is legal. I may not like it. I may agree with you and disagree with Nigel Farage, but you don't speak and I don't speak for society at large. And this is particularly acute in the United States, where the very definition of what is acceptable and what not acceptable speech now splits the country right down the middle. And I personally think this is where the politicians need to look more in the mirror, rather than constantly shout at Silicon Valley to come up with a Solomonic kind of compromise which they themselves have failed to. And so I just think on misinformation, yeah, it doesn't sound nice, does it? Misinformation. But when you then double-click and really look at what it actually means, it's, and then ask yourself whether you want that to be banned. And I'll just one... I'm really getting in a roll hill, but it's a really important point. During the pandemic, the governments, and I would have been in exactly the same position if I'd still been in government, were freaking out. Like, totally understand. Just imagine you're in government when people are dropping like flies. The vaccine hadn't been invented. No one knew where this thing had come from. There'd be this extraordinary, unprecedented shutdown. And at the time, the Biden administration became very, very alarmed and aggravated by what they felt was content that was circulating online, whether it's on YouTube, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's Facebook, which would discourage people from taking up vaccines. And it was, they called it vaccine content which would lead to vaccine hesitancy. That was the sort of jargon that came up. So I used to receive frequent calls, often in the dead of night, from the lead coordinators of the COVID effort from the White House, yelling at me sometimes, you must take this piece of content down, because if people see this on Facebook, they're less likely to take up a vaccine. And I remember vividly one. It was a piece of it was a satirical thing. And I remember it had Leonardo DiCaprio sitting on a sofa looking at a TV screen. And it had, these US medicinal adverts, they have all those caveats at the end. If you take this medicine, you may grow a second nose. You may develop bulbous growths on your elbows, and all that kind of weird stuff. And they had that, so it was like a satirical thing. Someone saying, in a few years' time, that's what you're going to remember that from if you take this vaccine. But it was satire. And I remember saying to this guy who was yelling, I said, "Are you serious? You want us now, at the behest of the government, to remove satire from the internet? You've got to be kidding!" I didn't do it. I was very firm in my view that we couldn't and shouldn't do that. But it's just a little example. He said, no, but it's misinformation. It's misinformation because it's satire, which is implying that there might be after effects. And I said, I don't know, there might be. I might be. But in any event, you can't ask the private sector to kind of suddenly start expunging satire. Now, it's an easy example for me to give you. There are many others that are, of course, way more edgy than that. But it is a little insight, I think, into the huge difficulty when people say, just get rid of misinformation, because it's, one person's truth is another person's right to have fun, or to, it's way, way, way harder that I think, than age verification, which I think, by contrast, actually has a simpler solution, which we should be taking up more than we currently are.
Right, I'm going to resist the urge to fight with you on that one. I actually think there's... So first, we have libel law, which actually we regulate speech all the time in other contexts. So you don't have to draw the line where you're getting into the really fuzzy cases to say, but actually anybody who knowingly or intentionally or with reckless disregard puts out speech they know is false, that we can punish. And then the only question is, can we hold the right, social media platform liable? And we can do that too, because we only need to worry about the stuff that goes viral. So you can say, so there are ways to think about doing.
Actually, can I say something just about that? Because stop me if it's not interesting, but I suspect you guys are here because you're interested in this stuff. This issue of the liability of the platforms is tremendously important, because there is this famous law in the US, it's Section 230 of the Communications Something-Something Act.
Decency Act.
What?
Decency Act.
It's 25 years old, right? And this is what they say, this is the kind of legend, if you like, in Silicon Valley, that without Section 230, the internet would never have evolved in the way that it did. Because what it more or less said, it's a two or three sentence clause, it says, as a platform where you are conveying, you're providing the pipework for human beings to say stuff and communicate with each other, you can't be held responsible for that content, because you're carrying the content, but you're not generating it, right? Like a telephone operator...
A newsstand.
What?
A newsstand.
A newsstand or a telecoms operator can't be held responsible for what we say to each other on the phone. Now, that held for a long time, but, I think it is collapsing at a very dramatic speed now, and I don't think Silicon Valley, or indeed governments around the world, have realized what's going to hit them, because, particularly Silicon Valley, because as many of you who use social media will see, more and more of the content that you now see is not actually a human being posting something and sending it to you or sharing it with you. It's content which is plucked from the farthest recesses of the internet by an algorithmic machine and then recommended to you because the system thinks you might be interested in it. Or, which of course will become even more the case now, synthetically generated content, generated either visual or other content generated by these very powerful new Gen AI content creation systems, and then recommended at you. And at that point, I'm not a lawyer. Larry, I just know what you think. I kind of think, how on earth can the platforms then claim they've got Section 230 protection? Because it's not carrying one human's content and another person's human's content. It's the platform itself recommending content, often content which they've generated synthetically and peppering it at you. And here's the great irony, is that the familiar critique, people like Professor Zuboff, the surveillance capitalism and so on, of social media, I always thought was totally wide of the mark, because it had this sort of caricature of the systems being able to sort of burrow into our neural pathways and control us completely, when in fact I think human beings under old social media had much more agency than that. Here's the irony. That critique, I think, is now becoming more and more true as social media mutates into a much more synthetically driven, automated experience. And I don't think, I was in Silicon Valley just a couple of weeks ago, I don't think folk in Silicon Valley have even got their head around what it would be like to operate their platforms when, if, you know, distressed individual X, you're seeing some of the litigation starting in US courts with some of the generative AI bots, but I don't think they've got their head around what it means to operate in a space now where more and more people are going to be using their services, and they won't enjoy Section 230 protection because they'll be inserting themselves directly into one half of the relationship which is being connected on their platform. So I think it's a massive deal.
Let's actually take a second on the surveillance capitalism point, because that's one of the other core critiques, and you touched on, I think, the heart of it, right? Which is, you mentioned earlier, the ad-driven model you think is a good model. The critique of that is, so these companies are hoovering up massive, massive amounts of information about each of us, and then the model drives them to have to sell it. And they sell it to companies who can then use it to target us. Now, there's a sense in which advertising, that's always what it's been, but I think the argument is, one, the sales are for all sorts of uses that may or may not be good or bad, and that two, the difference in degree is so great that we're not talking about just a quantitative difference between what old-fashioned advertising could do in terms of manipulating people. So it's not burrowing into your neural networks, but it is being vastly more sophisticated at manipulating people through this information that's hoovered up and then sold in ways that can be targeted very specifically, and that itself is a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. The ads I see on Facebook, I think, are pretty rubbish quite often. They're not well targeted at all. I don't understand sometimes what I get. I mean, I don't think I snore. Do I snore, Minnie? And I keep getting ads for snoring aids. I mean, I think they just...
I think she's...
I'm being a little bit facetious here, but I think this kind of description of these amazing things that, oh my God, they're just so accurate. Yeah, maybe a bit. But they have to be a bit. I mean, there's no point me receiving ads for a shoe shop in Melbourne, Australia, because I'm not going to go to a shoe shop in Melbourne, Australia. So it's kind of like, to that extent, yeah, receiving relevant ads, I kind of... And I just don't... I'll tell you two things why I just don't probably buy this. Is firstly, that the ads business, the commercial incentive on the platforms, actually incentivizes the platforms to do the opposite of what they're constantly alleged to do. Because the last thing you want, whether you're selling plastic ducks or garden furniture or washing up powder or cars, is have your ad next to some vile, revolting, still less illegal piece of content. So I think the advertising business model, which is held by the sort of Zuboff school, I think, totally misunderstands the obvious conclusion of that, is that if you're being paid by advertisers, and they don't run ads for you know, for illicit drugs and for, you know, for biochemical weapons and so on. They've got all the rules you'd expect on not running ads. They sometimes have controversies around when there's a kitchen knife, a weapon, and things, you know, things like that, which rightly blow up from time to time. But actually, the overall incentive is actually to have bland content on the platform, because that's what the advertisers want, who pay these people's lunch. That's the first thing. The second thing is, in as much as, I don't know, for those of you who look at the ads that you see while you're scrolling on screen, if, I mean, most people just flick right past them, but if you go on those three dots next to the ads, you've got way more control over what ads you see. Why do you see them, not seeing them, blocking them, saying you don't want to see them. You can now pay this, I think as of last week now, to pay a little subscription and have no ads at all. You've got much more control over ads online than you do in many other formats. So look, they're powerful systems. They're based absolutely on targeting. They're based absolutely on learning from a considerable amount of data something about the identities of people sufficient to be able to then target their ads. All of that, of course, is going to become increasingly automated by AI. So I think what you're going to increasingly see, so AI is clearly going to have a massive disruptive effect, and already is, on the advertising industry, because relatively soon, as an online, if you're a small, medium-sized company, you advertise on Facebook, relatively soon you'll be able to say, I want to target my galoshes to men between the ages of 45 and 65 in the Midlands who like hiking or something. And you will very quickly just be able to put that into the system, and not only will they be able to target the ad, the systems will be able to create the ad itself for you to be able to play around with. So I think this thing is highly automated, but I think there's a level of kind of visibility and transparency, and as I say, the fundamental commercial incentive is kind of weirdly the opposite of what the platforms are constantly being accused of doing. That's my view.
Okay. I have so many questions, but I want to get to some of the fun ones. In particular, you didn't write a tell-all book, but how do you explain and what do you make of the turnabout love fest from the tech bros with the Trump administration?
Yeah, I just think it's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean...
We know all these people, so...
Yeah. I mean, the first thing I'd say is, here was the weird thing. So there was I at a pretty senior level in Silicon Valley, and for the years that I was there, I was the only person in all these discussions about how to deal with governments and politics and elections and so on. I was the only person who'd ever been elected to anything, but I was always the first to say, look, you need to keep a kind of healthy distance from politics, particularly if you're a social media platform, because you're dealing in the most controversial thing possible, which is human speech. You're not building widgets, you're not sending off rockets to the sky, you know. It's speech, and that's why companies like that are never going to be more than a heartbeat away from controversy, because you're dealing with the thing that is the most important thing to all of us in many ways. It's communication, it's speech, and so on, including political speech. So I was always the first to say, and that was part of my job, was to rebuild relationships with governments and parliaments and lawmakers and regulators and so on. But I always said, look, innovation and great engineering and all the rest of it, in my view, generally takes place best at a certain arm's length distance from politics. So when you saw all these tech bros sort of stampede their way to Mar-a-Lago and enter into all these endless kind of deals with the Trump 2 administration, and you know Silicon Valley as well as I do, it's a very, one of the curious things about it, for those of you who haven't visited, is it's firstly, it's this center of extraordinary innovation and wealth and ingenuity. It's an exceptionally dull place to live. I mean, the sun shines all the time, but there's no culture, there's no street culture. Everyone just drives around their car. When Miriam and I tried to have dinner parties, people would turn up at 6. Well, you would stay much longer, but people would turn up at 6, they'd drink a sort of thimble full of wine, and they'd bugger off by 8:30. It was just absolutely... So it's a really weird contrast between the sort of energy of the engineering and the absolute flatness of it as a kind of place socially and culturally. But also the other thing is, as you know, the whole tech bro thing is that they believe that history is made by great individuals, men, for whom, which is why they all got this fascination with ancient Rome. You know, sort of great statues were erected for men who do great things. And then the sort of, all of us, the sort of Lilliputian folk down there, will admire these great men who will occupy Mars and do all these great things. That's the way they think. So they totally buy into the great man theory of history. And yet they also are slavishly herd-like in their behaviour. So when one or two of them go down to Mar-a-Lago, they go, oh shit, I better go down to Mar-a-Lago as well, because Jimmy next door is no doubt, you know, ingratiating themselves more successfully with the government. So it's so weird. You get this kind of hyper-individualistic culture combined with this absolute herd-like behaviour, which then has led to these extraordinary images of all of them lined up like a sort of school outing. But behind, you know, behind Trump at the inauguration, and all of them saying, "Oh, sir, you're so marvellous," you know, around the table in the White House. I hope that much as the pendulum has swung from kind of great almost animosity and suspicion between Silicon Valley and political power in DC, and has now swung the other way, I hope they find some kind of more sensible middle. There's only one thing which is worse in a kind of great capitalist economy like the US. There's only one thing worse than having businesses and governments at each other's throats. It's having them in each other's pockets. And I just think it's typical. It's the place just, it's so faddy. You get these fads and it just swung totally the other way. What are they going to do if a Democrat president comes along next? They're going to say, oh no, actually we agree with you. They can't keep doing that. Surely they've got to have a certain sort of through line where they don't keep in this sort of whiplash way, you know, swinging from left to right and back again. So I hope over time they kind of find a more sensible middle than is currently the case.
You're a nicer person than me. I mean, I'm just going to say, I think for most of them, in their heart of hearts, this is where they've always been. They felt super attacked for those years by people on the left. Trump finally gave them permission to express what they really think.
Well,
all of them, by the way. There are, you know,
sure,
I don't want to name names,
well,
but there are
many,
some.
Well, not that many exceptions. But I'll tell you what is true. But it's true just as an ex-politician, and this is just I'm just making a dispassionate political observation, is the Democrats spectacularly mishandle Silicon Valley. I mean, to go from having basically the whole of the Silicon Valley support the Democrat Party, as they did for years, to basically having all of them line up behind Donald Trump, I mean, just as an ex-politician, that is a spectacular own goal, that you haven't worked out a way of trying to split them a bit off from each other, or keep at least some people on side. And whatever you say about big tech and Silicon Valley, these are very important entities. They generate a huge amount of donations for the Democrat Party, because I'll tell you what, Wall Street isn't giving the Democrat Party any anymore. So I agree with you that this kind of, oh gosh, Biden administration wasn't nice to us, we'll be nice to the next lot. I agree with you, it's pretty unseemly. But just as a political fact, is the Democrat Party just kind of try and ignore the whole or berate the whole of Silicon Valley going for? I don't think that's going to work very well for them. They're going to have to work some way of having a better relationship with Silicon Valley in future, it seems to me.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Okay, so I want to ask two last questions and then we'll hopefully get some time from the audience. One on broader issues. So tech issues are just one of the arenas in which the US and China are now locked in a kind of cool war, not quite a cold war yet. How do you think the two sides are faring against each other, and is there a way out of this?
So to be much briefer than I've been, I think that there is an assertion is being made day in, day out by this new embrace of technological power in Silicon Valley and political power in DC, which, and the glue in that embrace, and you can hear it, they say it all the time, is that America is going to win against China in the race for AI supremacy. It's literally what they say over and over again. And my assertion is they can't win. They can't win and they won't win. And I think one of the biggest things that is going to shape the geopolitics of AI and Silicon Valley over the next few years is when the American sort of technology and political elite, when the penny drops, they can't beat China in AI. It won't happen. It's not like the Cold War, It's not like outspending, outmuscling the Soviet Union, and then having a sort of Berlin Wall moment when suddenly there's a victor and a vanquished in the conflict. The Chinese are way too good at this stuff. They've got a much, much more ambitious and, in my view, workable strategy on how to generate energy for this very energy-intensive industry. They've got some of the best AI data scientists on the planet, and they're producing legions of them from some of the best engineering schools in the world. They have none of the compunctions we've got about data privacy and data protection, so they can hoover up vast amounts of data. And as you know, at the moment, in the LLM paradigm of AI, that, by the way, might change, but right now it's a very data-hungry paradigm. And they are already leading. They're already beating the world in open sourcing AI models. And if you look at the leading open source models, almost all of them emanate from China. That is an extraordinary thing, that the world's largest autocracy is doing more to democratize the free access to some of these models than almost anywhere else. Slight exception, Mistral in France, Meta in the US, but if you look at the leaderboards of the open source models, the Chinese are already leading. So you can't win. You can contest, you can rival, you can compete, and so on and so forth, but you're not going to win. And in my view, that will lead to a dramatic shift, or at least should lead to a dramatic shift in thinking in America, away from thinking that you can just unilaterally, belligerently beat China, but instead, I think the Americans will need to relearn the importance of partnership with India, Europe, and others as this geostrategic technological standoff between China and the US evolves in the years ahead.
Okay, I gotta ask this last question because we're sitting here at a British university. It's kind of off topic, but I mentioned in the introduction that you made this politically what I regard as quite courageous decision 15 years ago.
Oh, you're not gonna go back to this.
I am going back to it. To reverse yourself on tuition fees.
Come on, Larry, it's 15 years ago.
Well, we're not going back to that decision. And as I say, I think it saved universities
at the time.
Great, I wouldn't
have
come. No, well, my question is, given everything that's happening to us now, and the current funding crisis that we're trying to deal with, you know, give us some reflections on what the UK should do to sustain this fantastic higher education system that is rapidly destroying. Then we'll go to the audience.
Least favorite topic.
I told him I was going to do this.
No, you did, actually. So this sounds super glib. It's not actually. I actually think in political terms, what is needed, a choice needs to be made. You just have to make a choice. If you think that higher education is essential to this country's prosperity in the future, you have to just choose, and then we'll come to all the different levers, you have to choose how to fund it and to fund it properly. And you can, boy, have I every minute since been criticized for the choice we made, but at least we made a choice, and we made a very big choice. And the big choice we made to increase tuition fees then had one very important effect. Obviously, it had not a great effect on my political career, but that is not important. It's to me, but not to you. But anyway, it exempted the university system from austerity in one foul swoop. It's basically what it is. So the university sector was the only sector, pretty well the only sector, where you saw spending or the influx of income massively increase during those austerity years. So much so that many university leaders now refer to that as the golden age of British union. I wish they'd bloody well said that at the time. Because at the time, they privately would come up to me and say, we're on our knees, we're going to collapse. And I said, oh, okay, well, I better do something about it. Did something about it, and they fled for the hills the moment there was any controversy. I mean, thank God they've got courageous leaders like you now running universities. Because at the time, I tell you, it was just unbelievable how the whole university leadership just went silent the moment they actually got what they'd been privately asking for. Anyway, that little bit of bitterness over. You have to make a choice. We made a choice. It was a controversial choice, but it was a choice. It was a choice to significantly rebalance how much money went in from the taxpayer and how much money went in as deferred payments from graduates on the basis that graduates, I'll come to that in a minute, earn much more than non-graduates do generally in the labour market. That was a choice. It wasn't a choice, by the way, which came out of nowhere. It was the Labour government, not that the Labour Party has ever chosen to ever admit to this, who introduced fees in the first place. They then, by the way, increased fees. This was even before I came into government, having said they wouldn't. They then commissioned the famous Brown Review from Lord Brown. that we then inherited in the coalition that advocated no upper limit to fees whatsoever. Anyway, and of course they've now increased fees, but only marginally. And so what they're doing now, which is the worst of all worlds, is that they recognise there's a huge problem, that the British university system is on its knees, and they've done this tiny little half decision on a small increase in fees, which will make bugger all difference. They then do totally countervailing things, which are going to make the situation worse by asking the university system to basically pay fees for foreign students. You've only got a number of variables. You've got some big variables. Taxpayer income, deferred graduate income, basically a graduate tax. And then, of course, there's all the detail about how you do that and the interest rates and so on and so forth. Foreign income and numbers. What you can't do is carry on increasing numbers, make it harder for foreign students, don't increase fees, and reduce taxpayer funds. You can't do that. Well, you can, but you will destroy the British university system. And I just kind of think you just need to make a choice, and I find it so frustrating, this government. It's going on about growth and prosperity. It's the one thing that we've still got a little bit left in this country. I mean, look at the great universities in London, you prominently amongst them. It's one of the few crown jewels we have left. Honestly, I was 7 years in Silicon Valley. No one ever took any interest at all in what happened in the United Kingdom amongst all these tech bros, except for two subjects. One, what did I think of Harry and Meghan? Which was basically not much at all. And secondly, oh, I've got my nephew at the university. I did my PhD there. The fabric, the connectivity that was so valuable to us. And we're screwing it up. So my one thing I would say, and of course, dare I say it, I'm afraid I'm exhibit number one, why they're not making the choice. Because everyone goes, oh, well, look, you can't touch that third rail. You'll end up getting mashed up like Nick Clegg. But that is the fundamental problem. No, that's the fundamental problem. People aren't choosing. And I do have this rather old-fashioned view. And I've said this to them privately. I'll say it again publicly or semi-publicly here. I know it's a hackneyed thing. To govern is to choose. And it's often to choose between a lot of very unpleasant, invidious choices. In mine, it was particularly invidious because I wasn't frigging prime minister. I hadn't won the election. I had no right. I had no mandate to apply my manifesto, particularly because the two larger parties at the time, Labour and Conservative, agreed with each other on this more than they did with the Lib Dems. So I had nowhere to go. I had no leverage. But setting that aside, you have to choose. And the longer we refuse to choose about universities, the more I think we will rue the day in 30 years, or maybe less, 15 years' time, we'll think, oh my God, why did we not do more to save the university system? It's criminal what's going on. Rant over.
But full agreement. Questions? So let's start over there. And do we have a mic up? We do. So we'll start over either one of those guys.
Thank you, Nick. My name is Elliot. I'm an urban policy researcher. I just thank you for your speech. But I also want to apologize for what happened in another scandal related to Liberal Democrat, which is the post office scandal, which is caused by the era of the technology system Horizon, which we kind of see the track record of relying on big tech. So the question I want to ask you is, how impressive you found Tony Blair's approach to technology company in Silicon Valley, especially like, you know, Larry Ellison, which is the billionaire owner of Oracle, is trying to push for digital ID in this country via Tony Blair Institute, who's also trying to join another group of US tech companies trying to buy the ownership of US TikTok, and Oracle want to be in charge of the algorithm. By the way, Laurie Ellison is also the big donor to IDF, so maybe any value he extracted from us creating data can be transferred to the IDF, which I will leave anyone else to judge it. So my question is, given the track record of big tech company, how would you approach the balance between tech power and people power? Thank you.
Wow. Post office, Horizon, Blair, ID cards, Ellison. That is a smorgasbord of good topics. What can I usefully say?
Pick one.
I'll pick one, which is I've become more French in my thinking about tech sovereignty. I think the the sort of uncritical over-reliance on American tech in this country is now a real danger to the sovereignty of this country. There isn't a single bit of the tech stack, the core tech stack, which is not owned, run, administered by the US. Our phones are US designed, all the software apps are basically US operating systems, the two of them are US. Your data is stored on AWS, Azure, and so on US cloud. Just imagine if they were French. It's really important, it's sometimes worth remembering this. Just imagine what the Daily Mail and Farage and people in Parliament say if all that dependency was the French, even though they're just a few miles across the channel. But because we've had this fantastically intimate and positive relationship across the Atlantic in the post-war period, we've just become completely inured to the comprehensive loss of agency and sovereignty. And that would be fine if the intimacy of that relationship between the US and the UK was going to carry on. But it's not. It's ending. It's gone. The post-Cold War amity between Europe and the US has gone for good. It's not just Trump. It's much deeper than that. It's for a whole bunch of wider reasons. The end of the Cold War. The US, we've been on notice this for years in this country. Obama first said it. Needs to pay more attention to the Pacific. There are also cultural reasons. I find it maddening that the British political and media establishment don't focus more, as they do in other European countries. They haven't got the solution, but they do at least worry about this complete wholesale overreliance. Look at this visit recently from Trump, and the sort of almost embarrassing, debasing way that we sort of clung on to the coattails of Uncle Sam, and sort of, it was just pathetic. It was pathetic. And all these ministers were saying, oh my gosh, some of these big tech companies, they're going to build a shed in Newcastle. I'm being a bit facetious, but they are sheds. They're literally, these data centers are literally sheds with racks in them with GPUs. Those GPUs, by the way, they depreciate after about 18 months. But the idea that, oh, hurrah, we've got a shed in Newcastle. And look, NVIDIA has said we're a nice place. Oh my gosh, it feels so good to be British. It's pathetic. We have to learn to stand on our own two feet more. That's such an LSE way to applaud.
It's like being at a sort of Lib Dem conference again.
Used to drive me mad. The other parties, they'd be really like this and clapping, and the Lib Dems would be like this. So I actually think there is a big problem. I don't think there is an easy and immediate solution, but simply relying even more on the American tech stack to do everything for us, which is the direction of public policy at the moment, seems to be a dumb thing to do. In my view, that far more attention should be devoted to why on earth we, and across Europe, why is it that we constantly come up with actually good ideas? Do you know the two of the most important companies on the planet who are absolutely essential in the sort of supply chain for AI, TSMC in Taiwan that produced the chips, and ASML that produced the lithography, the design for the chips in the Netherlands, were both spin-outs from Philips, from a European company. Do you know how many of these companies in Silicon Valley are now run by Europeans, or DeepMind that is, you know, by European salt? So we not only ingest all their technology, when we have good people and good ideas, we ship them over there as well. This is crazy. At some point we've got to, the Americans quite rightly on military matters keep saying, you've got to stand more on your own two feet. You've got to spend more money. I actually start to agree with them on that. Well, then we should also do that in the tech stack. And so, okay, I've made my point.
Okay, so what we're going to do is take three questions, and then we'll finish. So let's go here for one. So the guy in the dark jacket with the gray shirt who, yeah, had his hand up all through, and I kept saying, I'll get to you later. And that's this is interestingly all male hands.
No, up there.
Where?
Ladies up there.
Ah, there we go. Okay, up there. They'll bring the mic to you in a minute. So go ahead. First question. Yeah, there you are.
Hi, Nick. I'm George. I'm 17.
Speak louder.
My question for you is, when you look at the rise of reform and how Labour won 63% of seats with 34% of the vote at the last election, do you think the UK can kind of organically evolve from a two-party system to a multi-party system so long as first-past-the-post remains in place?
Okay, great question. Great question. The others. Great question. Love that. Second question was up there.
Love a question about electric
Hi, my name is Mark. I'm a student in political behavior. I really understood the point that there might be over-viralification of a big tech and that we might over-amplify the risk today with the hype, the scare of new tech. But there is a risk. It's not everything, but it's here. Mm. But in terms of solution, concrete solutions, what would you advise? When we think about the DSA regulations regarding disinformation, misinformation, or even the presence of illegal content online, what's your position? What do you think we should actually concretely do?
Yeah.
And last question. Where are you? No. There you are.
Hi, Ivana Jurcevic. I have a very big concern on tech and Facebook and various other things. I'm Croatian, and in Croatia we have a government in power which is actually still communist. It sounds a bit odd because it's apparently democracy, but it's not. And so what we experience in Croatia is that Croatians who are not communists are actually blocked to say anything which is actually against the government. And we are in the EU, just so you know. So I wonder, and you will know probably, how come that they managed to block our actually free speech, which is absolutely nothing nasty or anything like that. It's just they don't want us to actually expose their corruption, and they are very corrupt, I can tell you that much. So please, fast checker, how do they get paid by the governments? And we don't have money. The public doesn't have money to pay them. So I think there is a massive issue here with obviously private and public kind of who is running what and who is paying for what. And I wonder if you agree with that, and is that a massive concern across the world as well? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, sir. Those are kind of related, but
I'm afraid I just can't. I just don't know the situation in Croatia. I don't know what level of censorship you're talking about. I'm sorry, it sounds very evasive. I literally just don't know what the content moderation is that is being forced upon, I think you say, is the platforms by the government. I just really, really don't know. You mentioned, I think, fact-checkers. Fact-checkers is a super fraught thing because a lot of people like the idea of, it sounds good, doesn't it? Fact-checkers, oh, they check the facts. The problem is, it's the age-old thing, you know, same facts get interpreted in different ways.
Absolutely.
In the US, fact-checking basically lost all legitimacy because around half the population in the US basically thinks that fact-checking was kind of ideologically opposed to their interests. So the companies are now trying to do a different version of it. They're trying to do a sort of crowdsourcing Wikipedia approach to misinformation where users get involved in it. But jury's out whether that really works yet.
See, those two questions is related. One concern is what do you do about misinformation, disinformation?
The question wasn't about misinformation, disinformation. It was just generally, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And one of the other concerns, though, is about the particular power of some governments to, because of their ability and greater resources and access, to use social media to undermine democracy. So that's not the Soviet, that's like the actual government in a country, in the Philippines or something, right, using it to distribute.
Well, look, these companies, and I had this constant issue, is that governments would ask us to censor content that we didn't want to, and I would then say, because that was part of my response, I would then say no to demands in Turkey or Vietnam. I don't actually remember it ever happening when I was there in Croatia, but you definitely have authoritarian, semi-authoritarian, and you then say no, and then they would say, well, in that case we're going to block your apps altogether, which is what's happened recently in Thailand, and then there was huge public demonstrations against that measure, and the government was forced to. But it's a huge, huge step for a company to have its services completely shut down, because then it means that in resisting attempts by these semi-authoritarian governments to censor speech, you're depriving everybody of speech. So it's a super difficult judgment to make. And in democracies, or at least ostensible democracies, the companies quite understandably say, well, it's the government of the day. They've been elected. It's like it's not our right to second guess what a democratic government wants. I'll tell you a very good example where this comes up a lot, or came up a lot, was in India. In India, there's a huge concern amongst the powers that be, which, as you know, are very much driven by the sort of Hindu nationalist outlook of the Modi government, about inter-ethnic tensions and violence and so on. And all the platforms, the American platforms, would be put under huge pressure by the world's largest democracy to take down this content and take down that content. And after a while, as a private company, you kind of slightly run out. You say, no, this is not in accordance with our content standards. And after a while, they say, hey, we're the government. We're the democratically elected government. You have no right. You're not elected. You've got no legitimacy to kind of second guess what we want. And it's a super difficult thing. I'm not asking you to sympathize with the platforms, but it's tricky because you're dealing with some very conflicting, you know, you're very conflicting priorities here, because a lot of people quite understandably have huge misgivings about the unelected and unaccountable power of those platforms. But the problem is and then they want those unaccountable and unelected powers to be deployed against, you know, democratic governments who people might feel are doing the wrong thing. So it's a very tricky one. I don't know about Croatia. On generally, well, look, I'm afraid I'm going to have to give you the most annoying answer of the evening. Please read my book. There's several chapters about what I actually suggest you should do about it, particularly when it comes to AI. I think there are a whole bunch of things that, as I say, the major techno-democracies can do together to establish some guardrails on data use, on data flows, on transparency, on far greater user controls and user agency over their experience, to be far more transparent about how these foundation models, which are the sort of foundational layer of the AI stack, are trained in the first place. There's a lot that can and should be done. My point is, if everyone does their own thing in disparate ways, it not only becomes messy, it becomes very fragmented, which is why certainly when it comes to the regulation of AI or the regulation of the effects of AI, the more that can be done by the major techno-democracies together, the better. Now, the question about electoral reform. George, was it? Yeah. So, first thing I'd say is, it's going to be amazing to see what happens in the next election, because if you try and squeeze basically what we now have in this country is 4 or 5, in some parts of the country, 6-party politics through a 2-party mincer, which is what the first past the post is, you're going to get some crazy results. There was a local election result in Cornwall recently where the winner got 18% of the vote. So, you know, if the vote gets distributed like that, you're just going to get this winner-takes-all effect. And I think it's going to be like Russian roulette in a lot of parts of the country. It's going to be super, super weird. Do I think organically the first-past-the-post system will be changed? No. You need an act of parliament. You need a deliberate decision to change the electoral system. I completely failed in 2011 to persuade the British people in that hapless referendum to change the electoral system. And what I learned there was just a classic lesson in power politics. I thought, as it turned out very naively, that by putting on the ballot paper in 2011, not actually the electoral system that I preferred, which has always been a much more proportional system, but the system that the Labour Party had put in their manifesto in the recent election, because I knew there was no way that the Lib Dems on their own, with, you know, support of the independent newspaper editorial board, was going to win in a country which is deeply conservative about its politics, was going to win the case. So I thought, I have to get one of the other two larger parties to at least advocate for this. And of course, I didn't expect, I should have done, that the Labour Party, then suddenly being in opposition, the last thing they were actually going to do was stick to their manifesto commitment and actually campaign for electoral reform. So we got completely massacred, because both right and left basically campaigned against it, all sat on their hands. So you have to have one of the major parties in politics over a barrel. You have to have them completely over a barrel. Now, how you do that and in what circumstances that happens, I don't know. But this system is wholly unfit. It always was, but it's wholly unfit for the multi-party choices that people are now demonstrating in the ballot box. I think the sort of fragmentation on both right and left is here to stay. who knows, maybe it will require an electoral outcome at the next election, which is just so crackers and so kind of chaotic and so unrepresentative that maybe at that point people will realise that the game is up. And it'll be very interesting to see whether Nigel Farage, who ostensibly is in favour of electoral reform, continues to be in favour of electoral reform if he's riding high in the polls. History suggests that parties always love electoral reform when they're in opposition, and then have all sorts of excuses why it's just not top of their in tray when they get into government. But it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in the next election. It could be very, very, very chaotic.
Okay, so a couple things before we end, which will be in a second. So first, Nick and Miriam still have kids in school. So there's a book sale outside. Get some, and he'll stay on stage to sign some of them for a little while. As I understand it, also, Nick's rise in politics, which was somewhat meteoric, came about when there was a public debate, which was sort of the British public's first opportunity to see him in action. And he so demolished the other candidates who were there that it really created it. And you got to see why tonight. So thank you so much. Thank you all for coming. And go buy a book.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.